Please. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Las Vegas. We do most of our arguments here. We thought the council might be from Las Vegas on both sides, but it doesn't always turn out that way.
I am. I was born and raised here. Works for me.
That will not get you any points in this court. But good to hear anyway. All right. I'm joined in this session this afternoon with Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. Not very often we have employment-related issues that come before the court on oral arguments, so we obviously thought this was an important case, and we should hear from both sides on it. And just officially for the record, this is case 85360-COA, Nevada Secretary of State versus Wendland. It's the time set for the argument. Counsel are both present. Each side is entitled to 15 minutes. For the appellant, Mr. Young, do you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Sure. 3 minutes.
Okay. It's people usually ask for 5 minutes and then they never have it because they use their time up. So you're being realistic there. And also Mr. Velto for the respondent here. No rebuttal for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Although we had an argument recently where we allowed it because there were some new issues that came up very recently on the case, so both sides got extra time. All right, Judge Bull, is there anything you want to say before we start?
Welcome. We're happy to have you here. Thank you all for your briefing, and we look forward to the argument.
Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming down from Reno. Glad to see you here, Bruce, or Mr. Young, excuse me. Having formerly worked in the employment law arena, I'm looking forward to the arguments that both of you will present today.
Okay, you may proceed.
My name is Bruce Young. I'm a senior deputy attorney general and representing the Secretary of State of Nevada in this matter. The real issue in this matter, or the main issue, I would say, with regard to the basis for the appeal is, although originally it went forward on the basis of the jurisdictional argument, that was determined and decided by the Kassebaum decision by the Nevada Supreme Court. And the hearing officer, and then at the administrative level, the hearing officer's ruling, and then on the petition for judicial review by the district court, the issue that the state has with those rulings in number one.
Young, pull that microphone a little bit closer there. All right, thank you.
Okay. Is that there was a finding that despite the fact that there was noncompliance with NAC 284.65622B, there was a determination by the hearing officer that there was substantial compliance with that particular rule. And it's the state's position that the decision in Kassebaum precludes that aspect as a matter of law, that determination that there was substantial compliance, and I will explain the reasons why. In the Kassebaum decision, the Nevada Supreme Court held that despite the fact that it was not a jurisdictional rule, that NAC 284.65622B was a mandatory rule. And based on our briefing, I believe it is clear that it's a time and manner rule as well, because it sets forth the time in which a certain the appeal of the underlying discipline is to occur, and then the manner in which it's to occur, meaning what needs to be attached to the NPD 54 form, which is the appeal form that is required for the employees to use in order to initiate the appeal at the administrative level.
So, Mr. Young, I just want to clarify. So in Kassebaum, the Supreme Court didn't address whether strict or substantial compliance applies. They didn't address the case law dealing with that particular issue, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so that is ripe for this court to decide right now.
Yes.
In your view, what is the primary function of the attachment requirement in 284.65.622B?
It is to have the final decision reflected, and because the final decision that is submitted by the appointing authority sets forth the actual decision on the discipline and the date that the discipline becomes effective.
Okay. And as I was looking at your brief on page 22, you said that it was to provide, quote, notice of the actual final effective date of discipline, correct?
Correct.
And is that the same argument that you made to the hearing officer below, that that was the primary purpose?
I did not make the argument.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That
the secretary made below to the hearing officer, the person representing the secretary at that time.
I don't recall the exact verbiage of the argument that was made at that time. My recollection is that the argument that was made was that it was jurisdictional, and it wasn't necessarily, it was just a jurisdictional rule. I don't recall specifically, and I don't have that document in front of me or with me at this time to be able to say exactly what argument was made at that time. However, the fact is that Kassebaum made the determination that although it is not jurisdictional, the rule is mandatory, and it has the effect of law.
Right, and whether a rule is mandatory or not, isn't that one of the factors for substantial compliance, strict compliance? You consider whether it's mandatory, but that's only one of the things that the court considers.
Well, the case law that we cited in our brief, there's numerous Supreme Court cases. The Fort Bend County case versus Davis, the Hamer case, and the Manique case, they all indicate that if properly raised or invoked, a mandatory claim processing rule, which 284.65622B is, according to the Kassebaum decision, it is a mandatory claim processing rule. It must be enforced. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Fort Bend County, Hamer, and Manique. And the duty to dismiss is mandatory for failure to comply. That's what those cases indicate for the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. With regard to the Nevada Supreme Court, there are cases, the Markowitz case versus Saxon Special Servicing and the Holt versus Regional Trustee Services cases, which were cited by this court in the Gross versus U.S. Bank case, which I apologize for the inclusion of that in the brief. It is an unpublished decision of this court, which pursuant to Rule 36 should not have been in there. That was in my predecessor's draft, and I neglected to remove it.
We'll give you a pass on that.
However, the Markowitz case and the Holt case both state, and they go to the foreclosure mediation rule, which is a time and manner claim processing rule that requires the attachment of a particular document in order for the paperwork to be legitimate or enforced by the court.
Mr. Young, I apologize for interrupting you, but let me ask this question. How was the Attorney General's office or the Secretary of State, let me get the office correct. How was the Nevada Secretary of State hindered or not permitted to properly address the appeal because of the deficiency in attaching the document? I mean, they had the document. they knew the substance of what was contained in the document. So are you really asking us to promote form over substance here? I recognize you have some case law here, which is obviously something we need to pay attention to as well. But in the reality of the situation is, didn't the Secretary of State's office know what the charges were? Did they really need to have the paper attached?
The rule, the regulation, which is a mandatory regulation according to Kassebaum, requires the attachment in order to have an appropriate appeal. Was the Secretary of State hindered in any particular way? No, I don't believe so. But that's not the issue.
So what you're really telling this court is there can never be substantial compliance. It has to be completely procedurally correct for an appeal to be valid.
For a mandatory claim processing rule where the regulation sets forth specifically what is required, the Supreme Court in Kassebaum laid it out pretty clearly. They said, if it is not followed, NAC 284.6562-2B, if it's not followed, the appeal is defective. That is the wording that was used by the court.
What's the argument against substantial compliance other than your interpretation of the statute? We've got that very clearly. So why not substantial compliance?
Well, the decision in Kassebaum alludes to not, and it doesn't address as Judge Westbrook indicated, doesn't address the issue of substantial or strict compliance. What it does intimate or suggest in the synopsis of the opinion at the very beginning, it states that if the employee fails to comply with the attachment requirement, the appeal is defective. And then it says, and may be dismissed. And that's the language that my opponent has latched onto for purposes of allowing some sort of discretion. However, I think the remainder of the language in Kassebaum explains and or illuminates what is available with regard to possible cure. And that's the language that is used by the Supreme Court, is that the appellant, the individual who is appealing pursuant to this provision, must comply with all the requirements. And there was some argument that was made by Kassebaum as well as was made by opposing counsel here that the language on the actual form is somehow confusing. That was rejected completely by the Supreme Court in Kassebaum as well.
Counsel, I'm wondering if we can turn to the issue of due process.
Time is getting very short.
Yeah, we've got 4 minutes and 41 seconds left. So I'm wondering, under Loudermill, as long as an employee is given notice and an opportunity to respond at some point prior to the employee's termination, does it matter when that process is given?
Well, in this particular, my answer would be, it matters as long as it was given, as you indicated, prior to the actual final decision and discipline that was issued.
Is there a separate due process right during an investigation?
I do not believe so. I believe it is addressed in our briefing that, and there's cases that have been cited that indicate that generally the due process does not attach because it attaches to the property or liberty interests and not to the right to a fabulous investigation or a bad investigation. You are entitled to an investigation. And under these circumstances, it's clear that that occurred, the individual was provided notice of the charges in the specificity of charges prior to the actual discipline being administered. And with regard to further due process and the right to address and oppose, that is given as well in the pre-disciplinary review hearing that is granted pursuant to statute and regulation as well, all of which occurred in this matter, all of which Mr. Wendland was represented by counsel at all stages. And just getting quickly back to the other The cure aspect of the failure to comply with the regulation, Mr. Wendland was represented by counsel. Mr. Wendland was aware of the filing of the motion to dismiss based on the failure to comply, and no attempt to amend or cure was made by Mr. Wendland. And based on the suggestion in the Kassebaum decision that that is when and how one can avoid the strict compliance requirement of this particular regulation, that was not done. And under those circumstances, I believe the case law indicates that the rule was properly invoked. It was not addressed. It was not cured. And the individual had the opportunity to and did not do so. And then under those circumstances, the hearing officer and the district court were required to dismiss the matter based on the failure to comply and to cure the defective.
What about substantive due process, Mr. Young? What about that? I mean, right now, all we're left with from this appeal are generalized allegations of misconduct, because the specific allegations, I understand the appeals officer handled them and dismissed them, and they are not part of the appeal. They are not challenged by the Secretary of State's office on appeal. So all we're left with are the general allegations of misconduct. Is that sufficient to uphold termination?
I believe it was, our argument was that it was inappropriate for the hearing officer to not address the general allegations because she chose not to. And she refused to address any of those, even though we, and she refused
based
to
on
allow
the procedural due process
on
issue.
Her determination that.
So the question is, if those are addressed on remand, assuming you're successful, will that be enough to result in a termination?
It is the state's position, the Secretary of State's position, that yes, all of that evidence will support, and it will, under the O'Keefe standard, it will show forth substantial evidence to support the allegations in the specificity of charges and to uphold the decision that was made.
Can I ask a quick question about O'Keefe? That case dealt with termination as a first-time disciplinary measure. In this case, the hearing officer found that in 2018 there was an incident of paper pushing that was previously, discipline had already been issued, so it couldn't be the basis for discipline in this case. Is this a first-time disciplinary measure such that O'Keefe even applies? Or is this a second-time disciplinary measure?
It's a cumulative aspect. So arguably, it could be viewed as not an initial discipline, but a cumulative discipline under the circumstances.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Young, you've gone over time, but the court asked several questions that kept you going, so you'll be still awarded 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Beltos here. Most of the last presentation dealt with the first issue regarding the notice and the form and mandatory application of the law. We tried to get into the due process. We didn't get too far into it, but I would suggest you spend some time on that issue too.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, Chief, as well as the other members of the Court of Appeals, judges. My name is Alex Velto. I'm here for respondent, Mr. Justice Wendland. May it please the court. There are two issues in this case, whether Mr. Wendland substantially complied with NAC 284.6562 and whether the hearing officer abused her discretion in concluding there was a due process violation. As to the first issue, Mr. Wendland substantially complied with the regulation or there was an exception that applies. I want to focus first on this substantial compliance argument. The notion that just because the regulation uses the word must means that it is mandatory and substantial compliance is not allowed is disproven by Sadikoi Bay. I think Sadikoi Bay is where this court needs to look when assessing whether or not substantial compliance applies. Santa Clara Bay analyzed substantial compliance in the context of a redemption statute that used the word must. The court concluded that even though it used the word must, it was a form and content rule, not a time and manner rule. I disagree with Mr. Young in the sense that this was not a time and manner restriction. The time is must be filed within 10 days. The manner is the process with which it would be delivered. The form and content deal with the content of what is delivered. Now, this goes to what is included in the notice of appeal. Now, that court determined that substantial compliance was applicable, even though there was the word must, because the purpose of the language, as well as policy and equitable considerations, deemed substantial compliance appropriate. Now, we want to look at whether we want to avoid harsh, overly broad penalties on employees. It's important to think about who is fighting this appeal and who is likely to be prejudiced. An independent party that is an employee going through the system might not have the knowledge of what is going to be required, especially considering the form they're given does not specify everything that needs to be included. Now, I understand in Kassenbaum, this court said that that does not warrant failing to comply. Kassenbaum is largely distinct. Court didn't reach the, didn't have the issue presented of substantial compliance, and it wasn't briefed by the parties or raised. The substantial compliance looks at whether the responding party had actual knowledge and whether they would suffer prejudice. Now, Mr. Young has conceded that the Secretary of State's office did not suffer any prejudice. So the question is whether they had knowledge. As this court raised, they had control of the document and the operative document. So the only question is, what is the purpose of that form being included? Now, the purpose of that form is to provide notice to the hearing officer of the date of termination. The hearing officer analyzed the documents presented before them with the appeal, included that. The SPD form included the date of termination. So it was sufficient to provide that. Now, another layer of this I want you to look at is the policy language under NRS 284.010. This court has already determined in Kassenbaum what the purpose is. I'm sorry, the Supreme Court has determined what the purpose is of having this notice of discharge, or notice of discipline included in the appeal, and that's to provide notice of the date. Now, further on that, the purpose of this general scheme, the regulatory scheme, is to allow for employees to have a fair and equal opportunity for public service. That's outlined in NRS 284.010. I think you should consider that when you're looking at whether substantial compliance is applicable, because it we want to encourage employees to be able to have employment and be able to navigate the system in the process throughout. Now, the argument raised by opposing counsel that Kassenbaum is dispositive of this, I think, is inappropriate. The Supreme Court indicated in its ruling in Kassenbaum that there can be an avenue for the hearing officer to maintain jurisdiction of the case, and that this is not divested of jurisdiction. The hearing officer did the analysis as to whether substantial compliance is applicable, and I think rather thoroughly in her order, indicating that there was no actual prejudice, as well as the state being on notice. And because of that, the hearing officer balanced the equities and determined that substantial compliance was applicable, and Mr. Wendland substantially complied with that notice of appeal. The other issue raised by Mr. Young and raised by this court in Kassenbaum is that there might be an avenue to amend or cure a deficient notice. I would note first that if this court determines that substantial compliance is applicable, it would be arguably irrelevant to require a party to amend or cure their appeal if the appeal provided sufficient notice. Here, the appeal did that. It indicated the specificity of charges, which outlined the allegations that were under investigation, as well as indicating the date that he was terminated, which I think is sufficient to establish substantial compliance. But I will note that there's nothing under NRS or NAC that gives a party an avenue to amend their notice of appeal. And in the hearing officer's own policies for motion practice, there's nothing in there that deals with appealing or motions to appeal in order to give a party an opportunity to appeal their, to amend their appeal that they've submitted. So I don't think that that would be a proper remedy. I don't think this court should enforce that as a remedy retroactively on Mr. Wendland when Mr. Wendland, in fact, substantially complied.
Mr. Velto, if you don't mind, I'd like to turn to the issue of the due process.
Sure.
One of the arguments you make in your brief is that under Jones versus Nevada Commission on Judicial Discipline, that Wendland was actually prejudiced by procedural violations during the investigation. What were the violations and how was he actually prejudiced?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor, for that question. I want to point out first, I would tend to agree generally that under Loudermill, there would be no attachment of due process in the investigatory stage except for there being actual prejudice, which is what the Jones case said specifically allows for there to be due process to attach in the predisciplinary stage during the investigation. There were multiple.
I'm sure if Jones actually says that. I think it says absent due process concerns, you have to establish actual prejudice from a procedural violation.
My apologies, Your Honor. Yes. So the actual prejudice that I think was established was threefold. The first is that the notices were untimely. The hearing officer conducted a multi-day hearing from multiple witnesses, and determined that as a result of that hearing, the state should have been on notice that these allegations occurred long before the state issued a notice of investigation.
Okay. And my question, specifically, the court found that the general allegations were untimely. How can general allegations, which have no date associated with them, how can they ever be untimely under NRS 284.387?
I think it draws back to the way that the allegations were characterized in the hearing. And at the hearing, when they were speaking about these allegations, it was clear that the conduct that was in the context of general allegations occurred long before. So long before the state would have had notice under that 30-day time frame to notice Mr. Wendland for the discipline. So this draws back to some of the explanation from Mr. Brett Olin, as well as the Secretary of State's office, characterizing what were the general allegations. Now, on the point of general allegations, I think that the hearing officer determined that they were vague and that they were not able to give Mr. Wendland adequate notice as he went through the investigatory process. One point I want to focus on and draw to is that the hearing officer concluded that the predisciplinary hearing that occurred down the road did not provide a remedy for Mr. Wendland to adequately rebut the claims because he was not permitted to submit evidence. And actually,
how was he not permitted to submit evidence at the pre-termination hearing? Wasn't he allowed to present whatever he wanted? He gave a position statement at that point. He had access to the investigation by Olin. He had the specificity of charges. He also had the second notice of employee rights pending investigation. He had everything in writing at that point and counsel. What more process was he entitled to at that hearing?
And this goes to the testimony from Mr. Jason Guinasso that occurred at the hearing as to how that hearing went down. Essentially, at the hearing, there was no opportunity for them to present subsequent evidence. So while we were able to submit a predisciplinary hearing statement, the actual hearing itself did not allow an opportunity for him to present evidence or call witnesses or present anything else which would have happened during the investigation. So if he would have adequately been interviewed, he could have said, here are six names of people that you should talk to that will rebut these claims. You're not able at a predisciplinary hearing to call witnesses. So because the investigation did not give him the opportunity to have the investigator look into witnesses.
Does Loudermill require any of that?
Loudermill requires adequate due process generally and requires an opportunity to be heard and respond. Part of that opportunity to be heard and respond, I think, requires the employee to be able to identify people as part of an investigation that may have information that could help the fact finder make a determination. But because the second notice didn't come till after the investigation concluded, there was no opportunity for that.
Did he have actual witnesses or other evidence, or is this hypothetical?
No, he definitely had extra witnesses and other evidence. And this is all
did he ask to bring them
to the, well, you, just procedurally for these claims in the state system, you are not allowed to bring witnesses to a predisciplinary hearing. It's not how the process works, and they wouldn't allow that to happen. But I will also draw back to, I think the court should recall the standard of review when it's analyzing the determination made by the hearing officer on this point. I think if the hearing officer's determination is supported by substantial evidence and not arbitrary or capricious, then this court shouldn't overturn that determination.
But when we're dealing with whether or not, as a matter of law, there was a due process violation, isn't that a question of law that we reviewed de novo?
I think the question of law reviewed de novo is what constitutes a due process violation. But the application of that due process violation and the factual findings that support it are vested with the hearing officer unless they're reversible under the legal standard for the court. And this hearing officer applied the legal standard of whether there was an actual due process violation and made factual findings based on her viewing of 4 days and 19 witnesses.
So it looks like the hearing officer was very strongly focused on NRS 284.387 in terms of finding various violations during the investigation itself. And I'm wondering, if you look at the plain language of that statute, where does it say that an employer has to interview an employee who is under investigation?
I would agree with you that 284.387 doesn't create that requirement. But I think that that portion of statute does deal with the process of internal investigations and adequate notice to the employee of what the allegations are. The hearing officer made independent findings that the notice was vague and ambiguous, which was contextualized by the witnesses. And I think the due process obligation to be able to rebut evidence under Loudermill and respond implies there to be some opportunity to identify folks who might have evidence or testimony that could be favorable to the person being disciplined.
Looking at the plain language of that same statute, where does it say that an employer has to consider evidence presented by an employee during the course of an investigation?
I would agree with you that NRS 284.387 does not say that language, but I think that's implied by the right of someone having due process to go through an investigation. I can't think of a situation where an employee goes to an interviewer and says, if it's being alleged against them that the employee, say, stole something, and the employee says, I was at a restaurant down the street and I was with my coworker, Jasmine. And if the investigator didn't interview Jasmine or didn't give an opportunity to interview Jasmine, I think that would constitute a due process violation. And at the predisciplinary hearing, you're not able to call a witness. And I think that that is substantiated in the record by Mr. Guarnaso's testimony when he talks about how that interview went down.
So would you agree in your answering brief, you didn't address the Secretary of State's argument that Loudermill controls the due process analysis and establishes what due process is required prior to a termination? Do you agree with that position?
I generally agree that Loudermill is dispositive of due process. And I think that the type of due process that is required is perhaps more broad than I think the Secretary of State's disposition is.
What Brett Olin was doing, he was merely investigating, correct? Or was he adjudicating?
So when you're making the findings of fact, the investigator is reaching certain conclusions as to what the findings are.
But did he do that in this case? I mean, as I'm looking at his investigative report, he merely summarizes all of the statements that are made by each of the witnesses, and he doesn't actually come to a conclusion.
I would agree with you, but I think it's a little mixed by someone who's doing an investigation when they're given the notice and said, here's your direction to do types of investigations. I think it's hard for an investigator to divorce what they're actually finding from what the allegations are. And I think a key parts with the investigation that are supported by the record is that Mr. Olin admitted that he did not allow Mr. Olin to submit subsequent evidence before producing his findings. The way this process works is Mr. Olin writes his findings, gives them to somebody else to look at and make a conclusion. If that person making that conclusion relies on findings that are not inclusive of everything that the employee would like to be in there, including, especially when they're given the opportunity to produce subsequent documents and rebut these allegations, and then that opportunity is taken away, I think that does create some sort of due process violation for there have been an neutral investigation.
Let me ask this question. The supplement that the respondent wanted to produce, Mr. Winland wanted to produce, would that have addressed some of these witness issues that were not fully developed at the time of the hearing?
I believe so. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Question on substantive due process. It appears that all we're left with right now are general allegations of misconduct. All the specific instances were discounted by the appeals officer. Is it your position that the general allegations are insufficient to support termination, and why?
I think they're first procedurally deficient because the process required by statute requires the employee to be on notice within 30 days after allegations are known or should have been known by the employer. The hearing officer reached conclusions that these allegations should have been known. As far as substantive due process, there are substantive due process issues with the manner with which the investigation occurred and the way the predisciplinary hearing occurred, and that Mr. Wellman was not able to present evidence or call witnesses. And again, I think these are things that the hearing officer made findings about that would be supported or should not be reversed unless there's a determination of arbitrary, capricious, or lack of substantial evidence. With that, I see my time is up.
I have an additional question, Your Honor. Is it your position that if employees continue to raise general complaints about Wendland's workplace behavior, the Secretary of State can never discipline him because it was on notice years ago that somebody had general complaints?
Absolutely not. If there are new allegations that are general in nature, so long as the employee is put on sufficient notice in the notice as to what the allegations are. So general allegations of you are performing poorly in the office and being mean to people. if there are specifics in a notice that say, here's what it happened, here's how it happened, so you can respond to the investigation adequately, that's great. That's totally okay. And Mr. Wendland would have to be responsive to those. So the answer to your question is no, I don't think that's the case. I think there's a little bit more explanation there.
Didn't the hearing officer in this case completely discount testimony of two of the witnesses? One of the IT individuals, I think Sherry Hedder was one, another one, I don't remember the man's name, but the court decided, or the hearing officer decided, they weren't relevant at all because they would have been general.
It was a sequencing effect by the hearing officer. The sequence was the allegations are too general to put the employee on notice, and as such, they are precluded, not the claims made by this individual as a witness are immaterial. That made them immaterial. Had the allegations put the employee on adequate notice, I think they would have become relevant. So I think the hearing officer's determination that there was a due process violation is what allowed the hearing officer to exclude their testimony.
So if we disagree that there was a due process violation, the hearing officer should have considered those.
I guess I would have to look more into the record as to how they were applicable. I struggle to say yes or no, given what their relevance could be is not before this court at the moment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Belto. Young, you have two more minutes. You might have noticed that. I didn't notice that most of the argument was on the due process issues. Of course, the court focused Mr. Belto in that direction. He did talk about the first issue, but you only have 2 minutes, so use it wisely.
Mr. Belto, he stated that there was a due process violation because everything that the employee would like to be in there wasn't allowed to be in there. That's not the Latimer standard. It's way beyond, just because that's what he would want to be in there does not create a due process violation. With regard to Mr. Belto, again, the substantial compliance, I'm sorry, he said that the SOC was sufficient, and that's been the argument all along. The SOC, I'm sorry, it is not the final decision. It does not have the actual date of the discipline. It does not have the final decision by the appointing authority. It is a recommendation, it is proposed discipline and proposed date that cannot satisfy in any way the requirements of 622B. The level of due process that's required by Loudermill was in fact met. Mr. Belto has agreed and has admitted that Mr. Wendland was allowed to submit a document at the predisciplinary hearing to set forth whatever arguments, whatever, if he wanted to attach exhibits or if he wanted to attach affidavits, all of that could have been done in that submission. And that was the opportunity for due process that he was allowed, and that satisfies the Loudermill requirements.
But if that had happened, would there have still been an investigation then? Would the hearing have been continued? Would there have been a continued investigation?
The predisciplinary
with his additional information?
I'm sorry, the predisciplinary officer has some discretion as to what they are to do with the information that is provided to them at the predisciplinary review. So I'm not personally aware, but I'm not saying that it's discounted as a possibility that could occur.
I do have one follow-up question. So if you're focused on now the general allegations of misconduct, which I think is what you would like the appeals officer perhaps to have considered more fully, if I understand correctly, if those general allegations came about more than 30 days before that notice, is that a problem for the Secretary of State in pursuing termination based on those allegations? If all we have left are the general allegations.
Not if they demonstrate continued behavior that is consistent with those that did occur within the 30-day time frame. It's like a continuing in a harassment situation, Title VII. You're allowed to go back and take a look at things, activities, conduct that occurred prior to the time frame, as long as some continued action occurs within the relevant time frame for bringing the new.
The appeals officer did not consider those because she felt they were vague.
That's my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Young, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We very much appreciate the